You ask, what is the factor that we think is bearing, most importantly, in the bond market now? And I would say that the unconstrained, ill-disciplined emission of debt by the United States Treasury, and of course, prior to that, by the Congress.
On Wealth Track, 40 years of market perspective from James Grant, what history tells us about today's markets.
Funding provided by ClearBridge Investments, First Eagle Investments, Royce Investment Partners, Baird, Matthews Asia, Strategus Asset Management, and Women Investing in Security and Education.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Wealth Track. I'm Consuelo Mack. History matters, as does historical perspective. Today's guest is rich in both. He is James Grant, financial thought leader, historian, founder, and editor of Grant's Interest Rate Observer, a twice-monthly journal he launched in 1983, 40 years ago this year. As he wrote at the time, its stated editorial mission was to keep its readers abreast of the things that cause rates to rise and fall, and of the forces that tilt the world toward inflation and deflation. When Grant launched his journal in 1983, 30-year treasuries yielded 12%. They are now around 5%. Three-month treasury bills were 9%. They are now above 5%. Paul Volcker was chairman of the Federal Reserve, and the greatest bull market in bonds was beginning. Interest rates rise was the headline of the page one article of the first edition of Grant's. As he explained in his 40th anniversary anthology, rates, in fact, continued to rise for the next 6 months before beginning the epical decline that would carry them in not quite four decades to lows unseen in four millennia. I asked Grant to give us his headline today.
Well, we go in for tradition around here, Consuelo, and I would stick with what worked. But I, rates proceeded to, of course, famously fall. But I would also observe, Consuelo, even then, we didn't go in for flamboyance in our journalism. I mean, nice interest rates rise. How is that for a non-sensational
headline?
It's very
succinct, exactly. And actually, it turns out that worked for about 6 months, right? And then they declined. So the greatest bull market in bonds in 40 years, that's how you started your career at Grant's Interest Rate Observer. Any seismic shifts now after the great decline in interest rates? Are we at an inflection point now of equal proportion?
I think so.
Okay.
The great bull market in bonds actually began in 1981, so that
right.
was 2 years earlier.
Yeah.
And it seems that it ended in 2021 at rates that were some of the lowest in the recorded history, Consuelo, of interest rates, which, as you know, is a 4,000-year story, and Sidney Homer and Dick Silla have recorded it. So nothing like the rates seen in 2020 and 21 had ever been recorded, such as, 16 or so trillion of securities worldwide priced to yield less than nothing. That was a first in four millennia. So perhaps it's not so surprising that the snap back from the all-time lowest, heretofore unimaginable, mm-hmm. rates should be rather a light show of speed and power and indeed of financial violence. So here we are.
So, Jim, does the Fed get any credit for this turnaround and this, quote, normalization of interest rates?
It was the agent of the suppression of the preceded it. So as for cause and effect, the inflation that the Fed belatedly recognized was in progress for many months before it stopped doing its so-called quantitative easing and began to move rates off zero. So I guess it wasn't the agent of the change, but it certainly has played a part.
You're keeping readers abreast of things that cause rates to rise and fall. What are you telling them about the causes of these interest rate rises at this point?
There was a feature of the bond market that is unusual in finance, and that is that interest rates have at least tended over the past 150 years to rise and fall at generation length intervals. So, 35 years down at the end of the Civil War to 1900, then up for 20 years, and down until 1946, and then famously up from 1946 to 81. That was the cycle that took us from 2.25% to 15% in the early Reagan years. Mm-hmm. And then 40 years of decline. So on historical form, there's nothing scientific about this. This is merely pattern recognition or something of the kind. So if the historical form holds, the greatest bond bull market might be succeeded by a bear market of some duration and power. And what is unusual about the beginnings of this, let's say it's a bear market, we're all guessing about these things. What is unusual is the sheer raw speed and power of it. In the preceding two bear markets of bonds, 1900 to 20 and 1946 to 81, the first 10 years took rates up only one percentage point, 10 basis points a year for 10 years. And so this time it's been, you know, like 0 to 60 in 4.5 seconds.
Right.
So that's one thing to note, that perhaps the way to frame this rise in rates is to place it in the hypothetical context, or the context of a hypothetical long trending bear market. And it's not going to be 5 percentage points every 2 years for the next 4 years. That would be rather impossible. But we might consider the possibility of a long trending. So people say, you know, higher for longer.
Yes.
And we are saying at Grants, tentatively, higher for much, 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 much longer. That's one thought about the current day, current state of things. A second is that there is a nice silver lining in this for a real saver, mm-hmm. which is that, if you are a bondholder, you get two coupon payments a year, and when rates are falling, you invest that interest income at ever lower rates, right? So if you bought a bond that yielded 12% in the 1980s, you were reinvesting the coupons at 10, 9, 8, 7, 6,
right.
at length, just about at nothing. Mm-hmm. So now you are investing, at least prospectively, investing at ever higher rates. So the phenomenon of interest on interest is in your favor. And there's a kind of a Bible of fixed income called Inside the Yield Book. And that Bible tells us that interest on interest can account for as much as 1/2 of the total return on a bond over the course of many years. So it's no small thing that that savers now can look for real, not necessarily inflation adjusted real, but like genuine, like non-fake rates of return. You walk by a bank for years and years and would say, the best rates in town, 0.003% per compounded, you know. And now you walk by, my goodness, there are whole numbers to the left of the decimal point. So it's quite striking.
But for bond investors, as you said, if we're going to be in a bear market, so that's great if you hold those until maturity. But if you want to sell them before maturity, you're dealing with losses, right?
To be sure, and considerable ones. If you were unlucky enough to have bought bonds in the wild and in the money growing on a tree phase of our finances in 2020 and 21, when everything, we had no interest rates, everything was, money was free. If you bought those long dated bonds, you were looking at a loss of as much as 1/2 of your principal now. Some of these 30-year bonds that came to market at 1.25%, or the 100-year bonds that came out of Europe yielding 2%, those things are down, as they say in the stock market, it's down 1/2. Oh, mm-hmm. Down 1/2? Yeah, down 50%. That takes a lot of silver lining to compensate for that.
The higher for longer, the way some bond managers are thinking are that the higher for longer is going to be kind of flat, but higher at these levels, which is not going to be as dangerous for bond investors as it would be were they to, you know, continuously ratchet higher.
It sounds eminently reasonable. And it is wholly unreasonable to expect that the rate of rise of the past 18 months would be sustained. It's arithmetic, so interest rates don't grow to the sky either. But, I think all this interest rate drama is quite humbling. There's a commentator on the Financial Times' comment section on a bond story recently, and the guy said, you know, this is the deepest market in the world, populated by the most sophisticated analysts in the world with the most powerful computers in the world, and nobody knows nothing, as it were. You have to approach this with great humility. And, you know, it's also, I think, useful to recall that during the 1970s, inflation came upon us in three distinct waves. And at the trough of each successive wave, there was always someone, some person of great prominence to say, well, glad that's over. But it wasn't over. Paul Volcker said that in 1971. He said, yes, things are looking much better now. No, they might have been looking better.
Right.
But it would be 10 years before Volcker himself, through the most brutal monetary policy, helped to effect an improvement. So, you know, about the future, we are all equally ignorant. The difference is that some of us know we know nothing and the others pretend.
Right. I remember in a previous Wealth Track appearance, you said that you wish that the Fed chairmen would adopt some of the humility that you're talking about. Is basically the future is unknowable.
And what is wanted, I think, is circumspection and common sense. And the dogmatism that was behind the assertion that inflation is transitory. How could they know that inflation was going to be transitory? We have to get away from this PhD standard, the improvisation of our monetary masters who, having earned a doctorate in economics, they think they know things they cannot possibly know. That will conclude my sermon, Consuelo, on that.
But here we are dealing with the reality that the Fed is run by PhDs, and that, as you eloquently put it in some issues of grants, that the gold standard has been replaced by the PhD standard, and it's a retrogression, not an evolution, of the Fed. But that's the reality. You're tracking the forces of inflation and deflation, yeah, and their impact in the market. So what are the forces that you're tracking right now that are or could have significant impact on the market?
You know, an interesting one, Consuelo, is the public credit. It's mm-hmm. a kind of an antique phrase from Alexander Hamilton, wrote a famous essay on the public credit, I think in 1791. But the public credit, the phrase has gone out of business. People, you know, during the modern monetary theory age, which seemed to last forever to those of us who thought it was a bunch of hooey, people thought that, the government can borrow all it likes because the dollar is the Coca-Cola of world monetary brands, right? What is notable now is that people have come around to observing that the supply of government securities might be greater than the demand for government securities at prevailing rates of interest. That is, the public credit is a thing, as mm-hmm. the young folks say, and that the thing might be out of balance. So you ask, what is the factor that we think is bearing most importantly in the bond market now? And I would say that the unconstrained, ill-disciplined emission of debt by mm-hmm. the United States Treasury, and of course prior to that by the Congress, that appears to be, they think, you know, people invoked fears of the public debt during the last phase of the bond bear market. I remember I myself, Consuelo, wrote pieces saying balance the budget. This is 1981 when it
right.
was a big deal when the gross public debt passed a trillion. Under Reagan, the public debt tripled, but interest rates were chopped in half, sawed in half. So the connection between the public credit and rates is by no means obvious or easily mm-hmm. Decipherable at every juncture, but there will come a time, apparently, when the world will have too many of these pieces of paper.
Are you seeing evidence of that?
Yeah, well, you can see it most obviously in the downgrades of the Treasury's credit by S&P in 10 years ago, I guess, and Fitch more recently.
But what did that do? I mean, what was the real world impact in the market?
It plants the seed in the minds of the market that there are limits to the Treasury's capacity to service its debts in good money. Mm-hmm. Now, the Treasury can, of course, call upon the Fed to print what they used to call shin plasters during the Revolutionary War. So they say, and that could be done. But if the question is servicing debt in good money, that certainly suggests constraints. So we first have to acknowledge there are constraints. Now, the entire setup in American public finance since 1981 has been, if you can imagine, the World Tennis Association, if there's such a thing, deciding that we're going to do away with baselines, we'll get rid of the baselines, we'll get rid of the sidelines, and at length we'll take down the net. And everyone can play without these irksome and bothersome constraints that interrupted so many games of tennis. Right, so 1971, the net came down. Actually, that's the first thing, the gold standard. What remained of the gold standard ended. And then, you know, you go on the next 50 years or so, and all these kind of New Year's resolutions for the fiscal side, you know, continual resolutions and the OMB and the CBO and the documents they emit and all the editorializing. So all this stuff is again, reminds me of a rather barren tennis court. And perhaps what is required is the getting some guy to repaint the baseline to start with, and maybe we don't have to bring the net back at its exact height. In 71, we might think about restoring, figuratively speaking, some kind of net. So I think what is wanted is a helpful kind of constriction on our emission of dollar bills and debts denominated in same.
However, the chances of that happening, Jim, are kind of zero.
Slim
to none. And so as investors, what do we do with this overhang? What is it, 50% of the government debt is 3 years or under maturity? So they're going to be rolling over at, you know, much, much higher rates. What do we do as investors?
I'm not strictly in the do this and do that line of work. But your question is well taken. We have to get up in the morning and do something. We can't just philosophize about it as I've been doing. So what do? So you have to, I think you have to prepare yourself armed with facts that we see. So one of the facts we see is that the world is, that people are shooting each other. And war, I guess, just behind grand opera, is the most expensive human endeavor. And we're looking at tens of billions of dollars in respective aid to Ukraine and Israel. We are looking, I would say it's obvious that we're looking at a much bigger defense budget. This on top of other federal spending that seems not to be reduced to compensate for defense outlays.
Right.
So I would say that the pressure on the supply side of the bond market will be persistent. I would say that the demands from the private sector, you know, credit is part of the sinews of war, famously, but it's also a sinew of peace, right? So you can have a terrific demand for credit in the market. You know, we're not going to abstract now from recessions. So I think the pressure on rates will be persistent, and I think that the credit problems will surface before very long. They're kind of nosing their way to the surface. But my credit is the promise to pay money, of course. What makes 5% dangerous today is the preceding 10 years of 0%. So all of these fragile financial structures, now revealed as fragile, are going to be tested by rising interest rates. So there'll be credit troubles that we have not seen for a while. There will be pressure on the consumer. Mortgage applications are down in a big way.
No, credit card debt is up. Defaults are up.
There's a funny saying years ago, it's a world of sin and sorrow. Well, it's it is a world of great things as well, but the sin and sorrow portion of the cycle, I think, will be rather more important than it was, say, during the money grows on trees era of the cycle, which incited and facilitated all these venture capital promotions, all the private equity promotion. So it'll be more interesting in so many ways. I mean, I think, Consuelo, one financial journalist to another, it's going to be good copy. What's wrong with that? But as for investors, I think we ought to be liquid. I think nice and liquid to take advantage of opportunities that will be presented to us by Mr. Market, who will certainly overreact to the downside as he has overreacted to the upside in so many ways over the course of so many years.
At some point, it will be a time of terrific opportunity when all of these forces are realized in the market and that we see serious problems emerging, right? And that's when it's will be good to have cash.
Yeah, well, there are opportunities now. I mean, for example, you can, we've been looking at small cap stocks and they are at record discounts. In the small cap world, there are bargains surfacing and the spread in valuation between the and market cap between the small size companies and the big ones, you know, the Magnificent Seven, so-called. It's at near record levels, and small caps have had the roughest ride in years and years and years. So there, all of the distortions that were evident during the time of very, very low rates and very heavy promotional, speculative promotional activity, all these distortions are coming to the fore and are being resolved. You see the occasional bankruptcy of a venture capital operation now and then. And so, I think things are shaking out, and that's kind of good, because capitalism needs failure to re-guide and redirect investment. That's why it needs market interest rates. And we have not had market interest rate. We've had a regime of price control with the attendant consequences that are always obvious in price control.
Jim, you just had your 40th anniversary investment conference for grants, and you had an array of really the smart money, really smart investors, very thoughtful investors there. You know, right. Michael Hartnett from B of A, and David Einhorn from Greenlight Capital, and a number of other luminaries from the investment world. So what were some of the highlights? What were some of the ideas that were coming out of that conference that you could share with us?
Here's one that's not yet on the front pages, but may well be in coming weeks, and that is the monetary tension in Japan. The Japanese have suppressed rates forever and ever, and their last holdout of negative rates, rates below zero. And the whole thought process in the Japanese monetary world was, we will continue to suppress rates and print money, but it's never going to work. So it's never going to work, meaning that there will never be inflation. So we'll just keep on doing it. But as David Dredge, one of our speakers, says, I have always asked myself, what if it works? So the Japanese rate of inflation is rising, has risen, and the Japanese central bank, the Bank of Japan, is getting a little bit worried about what will it do if inflation gets away from it and interest rates are higher than zero, because the market has been insisting on something more than zero. But you know, when you think about the size of the Japanese economy, the size of its bond market, and the presence of Japanese investors in other markets hoping to get a yield greater than zero, the possibilities for upset and turmoil are considerable if the Japanese lose control of their interest rate peg. So David calls this this peg in Japan, meaning the suppression of rates at zero, he calls it the most dangerous peg in the world. So that's something to keep our eyes on. It might be a source of turmoil and upset in the bond market, not originating in Washington, D.C.
Jim, what's your one recommendation for a long-term diversified portfolio?
You know, compound interest and the promise of compounding money, of interest on interest. This is now has returned as an investment proposition, and it's been gone forever, seemingly, but it's back now. It's a very good thing for savers.
Jim Grant, thank you so much for joining us on Wealth Track, and congratulations on the 40th anniversary of Grant's Interest Rate Observer.
Thank you, Consuela.
At the close of every Wealth Track, we try to give you one suggestion to help you build and protect your wealth over the long term. This week's action point comes to us courtesy of Jim Grant and a recent issue of Grant's Interest Rate Observer. It is take advantage of the interest on interest. Interest on interest is the returns from reinvesting semi-annual coupon income from bonds. Now that bonds are actually paying decent interest rates, the power of reinvesting them, compounding their returns, can add up. Grant's quoted the 1972 fixed income classic Inside the Yield Book, which stated, for most long-term bonds, the interest on interest feature is a surprisingly important part of the total compounded return to the bondholders, typically over half. Now, to update that, Grant interviewed Loomis Sayles' Dan Fuss, a great bond investor and regular WealthTrack guest in our early years. Fuss cautioned you don't want to extend your maturities too far, and secondarily, you really want to be very, very careful on the credit risk side. In the nick of time, Morningstar recently issued a list of gold-rated bond funds and ETFs, which included some high-quality short and intermediate-term ones. Among them are Baird Short-Term Bond, Schwab Short-Term U.S. Treasury ETF, and the Vanguard Short-Term Treasury ETF. As the title of a recent Grant's issue put it, there are bear bond market silver linings. Next week in part two of our Grant interview, he shares some important lessons learned from 40 years of covering the financial markets. In this week's extra feature, Grant shares the story behind the creation of Grant's Interest Rate Observer. It began with a dinner with his wife at the famed Oak Room in the Plaza Hotel. For those of you so inclined, please follow us on Facebook and our YouTube channel. Thanks for spending some of your precious time with us. Have a lovely weekend and make the week ahead a healthy, profitable, and productive one.